Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Janet Fitzmeyer et al. Versus Blimpy Midwest et al. For the appellant, Kraus Gentle Corporation, is Stephen Sanford, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee, Mr. Thomas J. Nicholson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Sanford, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Before I get started, I would want to introduce to the court Michael D., a lawyer from Des Moines, Iowa, who is admitted pro hac vici at the trial, actually participated in the trial of this matter, but will not be participating in the argument today. This is an appeal from 8 separate lawsuits joined into one. All the plaintiffs are franchisees or were franchisees of the Blimpy International franchise. All were issued or signed franchise agreements in the mid-1970s or 1990s, all at different times. Kraus Gentle, the appellant in this case, is a sub-franchisor of Blimpy International, the franchisor, but Kraus Gentle did not issue any of the franchises that came into controversy in this case. Instead had a contract with Blimpy International to perform certain duties and receive certain benefits. All the franchise agreements are directly or were directly between each of the plaintiffs and actually the plaintiff corporations and Blimpy International, who is not a party and never was a party to this case. Each plaintiff claimed that Kraus Gentle engaged in what would be termed a fraud and inducement. The case was tried in Sioux Falls over about 5 weeks, inauspiciously starting on September 11, 2001, and ending on October 12, 2001. The case was submitted to the jury on a lengthy special verdict form. Each of the plaintiffs had pled specifically the separate allegations of fraud that they were claiming. The special verdict form required the jury to go through each of those specified instances of alleged fraud and identify which they found and which they did not. Basically, 6 or 7 allegations, separate allegations of fraud were submitted with for each plaintiff. The jury returned a verdict that in essence said that most of the claims of fraud were unfounded, but in 7 of the 8 cases, so to speak, found at least one specification of fraud, some 2, some 3, returned a verdict of compensatory and punitive damages. All the franchises of the plaintiffs were operated as corporations. Their expert presented the damages as those suffered as corporate losses, but the case was submitted to the jury as plaintiffs as individuals and not as a corporation.
During the time that these alleged misrepresentations took place, did your clients understand they were dealing with individuals or corporate agents?
If I recall the record correctly, all the franchises are in the name of the corporations. I think it was understood that each party would be, each plaintiff would be forming a corporation if they had not already. Two of the franchises were transferred, were sold, actually 3 were sold to transferees who were already corporations. So there are some who formed corporations later, but I think the majority already had corporations. But in any event, it was quite evident that they were all going to be and were corporations.
Were those corporations solely owned corporations, or were there numerous stockholders in those corporations?
It's my understanding that the plaintiffs are the sole owners of all the corporate franchisees.
So in a way, this case then should be treated different than Landstrom's case, where they were required to bring it as a minority shareholder corporation claim.
The Landstrom rule and the rule in Tri-State Refining, we believe, apply to this case. Justice Sabers, your point is correct, and factually, that the Landstrom case involved a suit by a minority shareholder, and there were other non-joining shareholders. But we think the Landstrom rule still applies here, which I can get to.
What difference would it have made to your client whether the damages are sought by the individual whole owners of the corporation or by the corporation if the damages are essentially the same?
Well, first of all, the damages are corporate damages.
But your client, is the same proof was offered. You said the experts testified about corporate losses.
Right.
What difference does it make to your client whether you write a check to the individuals or to the corporations for these damages?
In a pure dollars and cents approach, it may not make all that much difference, but it didn't make any difference in Landstrom either. It didn't make any difference in Tri-State.
In Landstrom, minority shareholders were seeking to obtain corporate profits for themselves in an ongoing corporation, where there were other shareholders, majority shareholders, of course, that they were seeking to get those damages from, too. Whereas here we have, as you indicate, all the owners of the corporations are suing. So there's a big difference, I think, I see between this case and Landstrom.
Except that the rule in Landstrom is not confined, as I understand it, because it's a rule that is virtually effective nationwide, is not limited to the peculiar facts of Landstrom. The broad and universally accepted proposition in Landstrom is that a shareholder cannot bring a claim that really belongs to the corporation unless the shareholder proves that particular shareholder has suffered a kind of damage that is different from what other shareholders have suffered because of the corporate losses. The Grossap case is an interesting example of where a shareholder could bring a separate suit. In the Grossap International case, the shareholder was alleging intentional infliction of emotional distress. A corporation being a fiction of paper and law cannot suffer emotional distress. So in that case, this court allowed that kind of claim to proceed. No such relationship exists here because these are economic losses suffered by a corporation, and we believe that the Landstrom rule as a general principle still applies here.
Typically, that rule applies in instances where a defendant is concerned about the possibility of having to pay twice for two different plaintiffs, but here, that isn't a concern, is it?
One of the Landstrom concerns issues is paying twice. I think that is not the true gravamen of the Landstrom rule. The Landstrom rule, one of the big pieces of that is that it is the corporation that owns the cause of action, and it is the corporation who should bring the action in its own name and should decide whether to do it, and that it is simply not appropriate to allow shareholders to do that. And so...
What is the prejudice to your client, though? I mean, that's what I'm asking. What prejudice does your client suffer because the corporation didn't bring the action, but the shareholders did?
No more prejudice than if some guy off the street sued. We are still entitled to insist that the right plaintiff bring the cause of action. The party who has the cause of action needs to bring it. Under a real party and interest analysis, and really that's not even that here, prejudice is not the issue. This court and others across the land have been routinely insistent that claims be brought by the people they should be brought by. And so if we pick somebody off the street and let him be a plaintiff for someone else's cause of action, and the amount were the same, I suppose it could be argued since the dollar amount is the same, who cares who the plaintiff is? But that has not been the analysis that has prevailed in these cases in this court or in any other court that I know of. A defendant is entitled as a matter of law, always, everywhere, every time, to have the party properly holding the cause of action be the plaintiff. And if there is a bar to the proper party bringing the action, and there is a good defense, as there is here, the proper party having the cause of action who is barred cannot take someone off the street, so to speak, as in my example, and say, okay, I'll get around that by bringing up this other plaintiff.
What defense do you have here against the corporation that you don't have against the individual?
These cases were brought by individuals, the corporations, for different reasons, are legally barred, and that really hasn't been appealed directly. The Iowa corporations are barred by the Iowa statute of limitations. Some of the corporations are barred, one for failure to register. Others are barred because of the survival statute 47750 that establishes causes of action against dissolved corporations dissolve themselves if they're not brought within 2 years. And so these cases were deliberately brought as kind of all or nothing emotional appeal type cases. Small individuals, David and Goliath type approach, fraud only, no contract, no negligence claims, fraud only, designed to maximize the opportunity for emotional appeal and the recovery of punitive damages. So in fact, we say, okay, that was your choice, plaintiffs. The corporations, however, are the proper parties. You made a voluntary choice not to bring them until those corporations were barred.
So there's nothing in the franchise agreement that required these individual plaintiffs to form corporations in order to purchase the Blumpy franchise?
No.
That was solely their choice?
That's, yes.
Okay, and one other issue. The Landstrom exception is that if you have special damages as a stockholder, you can initiate your case.
Yes.
Now, factually, since these are closely held corporations, and as a matter of fact, wouldn't the damages be the same, even if they were special damages to each of the stockholders that were proven corporately in this case?
The losses proved are all corporate losses. There is no claim damages or recovered damages in this case that are peculiar to the shareholders.
Did any of the shareholders recover on their initial investment into the corporation?
There were several elements of possible damage. The awards, I believe, in each case on the special verdict form are all deal with losses presented as corporate losses.
But would they have included the initial investment they would have made in purchasing the franchise or capital investment into the corporation?
They were mainly capital losses of capital and operational losses, if I recall the verdict forms correctly. But the important thing is Mr. Sherman or Dr. Sherman, their expert, unabashedly said that these are losses incurred in the corporation. And of course, in Tri-State Refining, the Appaloosa Code, this court said that even though misrepresentations are made to an individual, where that individual forms a corporation and incurs the losses in the corporate form, then it is the corporation that is the proper party to bring the fraud action, even though representations were made to the individual before the corporation was formed.
Mr. Sanford, before you run out of time on the rest of the issues, there's a lot of issues in this case. And I don't want to cut off the other justices, but I want to make sure I get one question answered from you before you leave today. You prepared in your brief a very helpful chart of the jury verdicts as to each allegation of fraud and as to each plaintiff and what you have denominated as the support promise.
Yes.
Is one of those categories. And I notice in the special interrogatories, special interrogatory F, the jury found that Cross Gentle committed fraud by making these representations as to support, and I assume that's what that column is in your chart.
Yes.
As to support, business advice, expertise, etc., to make the stores profitable. Now, with the jury making that finding, isn't that sufficient, since we have to give the jury's verdict the benefit of all doubts? Isn't that sufficient to support the finding, at least as to, it looks to me, all but two of the plaintiffs, because the jury did find that way on all but two of the plaintiffs in this case?
There are at least two answers to that question. First of all, this is a promise of future performance. It was characterized at trial by counsel as a promise of future performance. Each one of the plaintiffs for whom that allegation of fraud was found by the jury admitted that they were provided support. I mean, Cross Channel did provide them support. They just didn't like it, or they didn't think it was good enough. None of the plaintiffs for whom that cause of action or that count was found by the jury offered a dime, a penny, a peso worth of evidence that at the time that representation was allegedly made, there was no intent to perform. And in fact, Cross Channel tried to perform. Each plaintiff said, in essence, that they thought there was no intent to perform because it didn't work out. This court has held that the breach of the promise itself or the disappointment by a plaintiff is simply insufficient as a matter of law support a proof of intent. So on intent, that's all there is.
But the jury was adequately instructed on future promises, was it not?
Yes.
And yet they found this special interrogatory. They found that Cross Gentle, or the plaintiff had proved their claim against Cross Gentle on this particular special interrogatory. That's got to assume that the requisites for future promises were
were satisfied or the jury wouldn't have found that way.
I don't mean to be flippant about your question, but taken literally, why would anyone appeal that? You just give up, regardless of whether there's any evidence. I mean, this court has established a tradition, rightly so, of making extra scrutiny of the record in cases of claims of fraudulent promises of future performance, because so often those claims are really just negligence or breach of contract claims. In Garrett v. Bankwest, this court held, even though there was a claim that Bankwest didn't intend to fulfill a promise, that there simply was no evidence, and held that because there was no evidence of intent, only that there was just the breach of the supposed promise, that was not enough as a matter of law. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, applying South Dakota law, and famous Brands v. David Sherman Corporation, 814 F. 2nd 517, said exactly the same thing. Garrett approved that.
Your time has expired, Mr. Sanford. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Nicholson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
It pleases the court, counsel, clerks, and I might note for the record that Rick Johnson is here with me today. He was, two of us tried that case. Our situation a little bit different than Mr. Sanford's. Mr. Sanford did not try the case. He was not present during any part of the case. And in his defense somewhat, when you're asking questions about the facts, there's something like 3,200 pages of transcript. Excuse me, I'm sure you didn't have a chance to read them all. But this is a unique appeal from our perspective. The defendants got in all their evidence. We're not objecting to that. We're not appealing on that. They got in every single one of their proposed instructions, or at least they're not appealing on any of them, except for one that they introduced. And then we objected to when they introduced, and the court granted it anyway. They came back later at a separate session after it had already been granted and submitted. I'm talking about the constructive fraud issue that they raised here. At a later session, before instructions were read to the jury, they then objected on the grounds that it was duplicitous, and that I think the word was no place for it, which is what we objected to it in the first place. And they did not ask to withdraw it. And then the court at this point, it's late, the court gives the instruction that they proposed. We're in a funny position on that. We objected to it, we didn't propose it. They didn't withdraw it. And when the body of the instructions were done, I think Mr. D, who actually tried the case with another lawyer from Des Moines, said something to the effect, these instructions are good or they're fine or something to that effect. They also proposed a verdict form that when taken with all the plaintiffs was 80-some pages long. It was their form. We objected to it. We gave an alternative, then we gave another alternative. We wrote a brief on it. They got their verdict form in. They were successful in getting all of our corporations thrown out of the lawsuit.
All right, let me just stop you there, because that's the issue I think we spent most of the morning talking about so far, is counsel represents that the only proper party in this action is the corporation, based upon cases like Appaloosa Company and other cases around the country. Why is he incorrect?
Well, first of all, I think we start from our perspective in that every one of these people were individuals when they were approached about this investment. under the franchise laws, you have to have a disclosure document, a circular, and you sign an acknowledgement for that by our franchise statutes. It's against the law to offer a franchise without that. Every single one of those acknowledgements and the information that's required to buy a franchise is signed by an individual. They paid their own money to buy the franchise. Except, in contrary to what Mr. Sanford told you, there were only two plaintiffs that had existing corporations, and they were doing totally other things. One was an office store, or related to an office store, and the other was some investment type thing. And because it would have probably cost attorney's fees or whatever to form another corporation, later on, they transferred this franchise into the corporation. And, you know, 2010-1, I think, is kind of a instructive statute. It says, one who willfully deceives another with intent to induce him to alter his position to his injury or risk is liable for any damage that that person suffers. And if you go to the verdict form, the jury found, if you go to Special Verdict Form B, which is tab 1 on our brief, question number 1 on Form B, do you find that plaintiff Janet Frischmeyer, and this is just one of the plaintiffs, and it was like this in every one of them, purchased a Blimpy franchise in her personal capacity rather than her capacity as a corporate agent? Yes. And there's also an instruction, I think it's 62A, that instructs the jury that they can't duplicate their award. And as I read those cases, that's the real fear.
You implied earlier that they made a motion which caused your all of your corporations to get kicked out of the lawsuit. Is that true?
Here's how it happened. The Iowa corporations were out first. We named them as parties partway into the lawsuit, and the statute of limitations had run. Our argument was that it was a relation back situation. We lost that motion to the trial court. So when we went to court, to the trial, we didn't have the Iowa corporations in. It was just the Iowa plaintiffs. Then during the trial, and I think Steve's accurate why two of the corporations weren't there is because they didn't have activity, there was also one or two other corporations. When we got to the end of the evidence, the judge said to us, you have to pick. You're either sending to the jury, you're either sending individuals back there as plaintiffs or corporations. I'm not sending both. We were put in the position, obviously, at that point, we felt that the individuals were the base here anyway. They were the ones lied to. I mean, none of them were lied to as corporations. Matter of fact, it's illegal under the franchise laws to even assume that since they signed the acknowledgments as individuals.
What was the theory of the trial court in making that ruling? In making you to elect?
I'm going to be very honest with you, Justice Zinter, I don't remember. There was a lot going on at that time. I didn't argue that motion. I was preparing for closing argument. She didn't want both of them to go to the jury, and I can't remember if it was because I don't want to mislead the court because I don't remember.
Weren't the damages, however, all the corporate damages?
No. First of all, a lot of them used their own money, and I can't itemize off the top of my head, and I don't want to mislead the court and say it was every plaintiff, but they put their $18,000 out of their own pocket by borrowing the money to get this franchise purchased. They were also pouring their individual money into this corporation the whole time to keep it going.
And that was all before the jury.
Yes, they had all of that. And there was 5 weeks of evidence here. They heard all of that. They got all their evidence in on all of that. And the jury found on that verdict form it was the individual.
Yeah, but there's no, in question 6 on the special interrogatory, there's no category for the $18,000 or the other losses that they would have suffered in a personal capacity that I see.
Question 6 It was never answered by any of them, because if you're on Form B, because they were instructed to skip six if they found yes on number one. So then they would go to question, the similar one to that would be question number 11. And you have to read that in conjunction with the answer to question number one. Because question number one says, who purchased it? The person or the corporation? They said the person. Then you go to question number seven, and it says, or excuse me, number 11, and it states that, you know, state the amount of damages. The plaintiff, Janet Fritzmeier, who's an individual, they could not have gotten to that had they not already found that the individual had had the loss. They would have, they wouldn't have been able to answer that question. So that was a prerequisite to getting there.
Now, Mr. Sanford has told the court today that all the plaintiffs voluntarily created corporations as a personal business decision. Do you dispute that?
No, I don't. They had to, after they had signed their acknowledgments and, you know, as a lot of people, they had a decision to make, we're going to have this little business, and they are just little sandwich shops. They form corporations as a way of doing business.
And then the franchise rights are transferred from the personal plaintiffs to those corporations, correct?
I think there are varying ways of doing it. In some cases, the corporation was formed in time to sign the contract, but they'd already signed their individual acknowledgments and they'd been induced to do it directly.
All right, but at the time, the corporations, the businesses ceased, the franchises were all held by the corporations and not by the personal plaintiffs, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Was there any evidence that any of the individuals were personally liable for any of these losses?
Oh, yes. Janet Fritzmeier lost her family farm that she inherited from her folks. They all went to the bank and borrowed more money.
So did they sign in their individual capacity as well as the corporation?
They had to sign individually at the bank, so, you know, banks wouldn't loan money to a small corporation without the individual. They all suffered money. You know, those corporate tax returns are just a way of gathering information for the economists. It's a little bit misleading to say the corporations were the only ones that suffered losses, because that's just a place for the economists to go to find information about where money is being spent, because that's where the record keeping is. And so I don't think that particular point of view about the tax returns is very relevant.
Well, under the special interrogatories, which category of loss would the Fritzmeier loss of farm have fallen under?
Capital losses, B. And, you know, the jury was they listened to 5 weeks of evidence, and they were very, you look at this verdict form, which, as you know from our brief, I won't go into that. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why that shouldn't have been, and it's very inconsistent. First of all, fraud is global. There's no question in here that is a combination of these questions. They've taken our allegations out of our complaint. That's a pleading requirement that you plead with particularity. There are 5 weeks of facts in this trial, and they tried to pigeonhole it into these few, and the jury still find fraud. And they found actual fraud, and they found punitive damages. In Iowa, it's clear and convincing of a willful act to even get that far. And their instructions, they had their instruction on intent, special knowledge, puffing and sales talk, not fraud. I mean, no duplicative award, punitive damage instruction, foreseeability, reliance. They had it all in there with the instructions that told the jury how to use this very convoluted, very difficult, verdict for them. It was so, they had that juiced up so one-sided of them, they even had a question in there that if you find that the plaintiffs didn't mitigate their damages, go to the end and they get zero. Well, that's not the law. If you don't mitigate, you stop where the mitigation is, and that's all you can recover, where you failed to mitigate, not that you get zero. I mean, this is a very onerous verdict form, and they still, the jury, that black and white issue that we briefed, I just want to touch on that, because that's very important. This is how the first part of that trial was. In December, before this trial started in September, the year before, they made a summary judgment motion. They submitted an undisputed statement of facts and an affidavit from the vice president of the Cross Channel that said, Blimpy Midwest is not a sub-franchisor. And the lawyers signed an undisputed statement of facts stating that. We get to the trial. An opening statement, Mr. D said to the jury, Blimpy Midwest is the sub-franchisor. And I think this is exactly what he said. I have a quote here. And that is, Cross Journal was not the sub-franchisor in this case. And he says it was the black and white issue you all have to decide. When Mr. Broderick, the vice president, was called to the stand, we went through numerous sub-franchisor agreements that Krauss General signed before and after these people were signed on. W-2s that paid the salesman that was out there. The fact that the franchise fees were deposited in Krauss General's account, and I can go on and on and on about the Krauss General, and he still maintained, no, it was Blimpy Midwest, until he pulled out that affidavit that he signed and showed it to him, said it must have been a mistake. Well, his own lawyer signed an undisputed statement of facts. And I've noticed they don't cover that in their brief, except they make a very brief statement. I think it was on page 2 of their summary and introduction. They say in there, Krauss General is not the sub-franchisor. They sneak it in there, and that's the only mention of it. That was extremely crucial to this jury, because there's that instruction, well, two of them actually, 8 and 11, that talk about if you believe that they're lying, or that they're giving inconsistent testimony, you can disregard everything they've said. And this, they got started in this trial. They're on trial for misrepresenting, and the jury right away, there's no doubt if you read that transcript, believe they're in there misrepresenting to them and to the judge. And they tried to do it again in this brief. And they had 5 weeks, the jury had 5 weeks to listen to that evidence. And they listened to everything they had to give them. And if you read every one of the issues that they raise, and you look in the instructions in the verdict form, you'll find that there's a roadmap there for the jury to deal with them. And most of the roadmap, if not all of it, was submitted to the court by the defendants.
You've only got a few minutes left. Tell me about your notice of appeal, notice of review, your cross appeal. Why did the trial court commit reversible error in ruling inadmissible the testimony of your client in relation to his brother?
Okay. That's Denton Olson, Your Honor, and that's Denton Olson had a small store down in northwestern Iowa. Or a small businessman down, an insurance agent. His brother Russell was on the board of directors of Krauss General. He knew that because his brother had told him. Mr. D admitted in court, on the record, to the court outside, in a hearing before the trial started, before the jury's brought in, that yes, in fact, Russell was on the board of directors, but they don't have anybody to submit it, and if Denton says it, it's hearsay. Well, here's why that is important, but it's not all important. Russell Olson comes to Denton Olson's office, and Denton wanted his wife there because this was a big decision for him to spend $18,000 or whatever it was, half of that, to get into this and then run a business because he already had one. He wanted his wife there for approval. So his brother comes down with Steve Abbott, whose name I'm sure you're familiar with in here. Mr. Abbott sits right next to him in a chair. and Russell Olson goes ahead and makes the representations about what the Limpies can do, so Denton buys in. Well, first of all, Russell Olson is a board of directors member of Krauss General, and his brother knew that. It's his brother. But secondly, even if he's not there in that capacity, Steve Abbott sat there, listened to all of it, and didn't disagree. Now, isn't that a tacit admission? I mean, isn't under the rules of evidence, isn't there an obligation to either agree or at least disagree? And when you remain silent, isn't that an agreement? And we were not allowed to. Matter of fact, I think he was dismissed at the end of our evidence because we weren't allowed to call him.
Before you finish, what about the argument about future promises?
Well, in almost every case, you know, the word promise is bannered around. It's probably misused. It's probably misused by me sometimes mistakenly when I visit with you or to someone else. But for example, I'm going to use the subway argument, advertising like Subway. What makes that so important, and you can say the same thing about a lot of these, is they knew. You know, Steve Abbott was asked, did anybody at Blimpie International ever tell you there's going to be advertising like Subway? Nope. And our people, do you know of anybody that outside of Krauss General people that told you it was going to be like Subway? No. All that Blimpie International people we found out in the trial told Krauss General is that there's going to be national advertising. Well, he juiced it all up to make the sale. So he's making a statement of a fact that he has no reason to believe is true. He made it up. Nobody, he even admitted. And he testifies in there, I'm the premier restaurateur and all this kind of thing. You know, I'm not going to belabor, but he had no really restaurant experience. He had no expertise. And he's building up Krauss General Corporation because they had a big name in Iowa. They're a very large company. They own hundreds of come-and-go stores, and they have, and Mr. Krauss has interest in Liberty Banks, Liberty Leasing, all kinds of things. And that name is very important. And they were using it to make the sales. And they were saying things that they knew they couldn't deliver on, that our people didn't know. There were all kinds of things in a sub-franchise agreement, or a sub-franchise manual that was given to them, that told them what to tell our people about. Don't have them be here if the population isn't a certain thing. If the location is in a certain place, don't have them be there. They never told our people any of that. There's a lot of fraud and silence, too.
Your time is well expired, but I assume this was all an answer to Justice Zinner's question. Thank you. Mr. Sanford, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Why was the trial court right in rejecting the offer of proof made by your opponent in relation to the Denton Olson testimony?
First of all, the standard, of course, is abuse of discretion because it's an evidentiary ruling. The Denton Olson deal, while his brother was on the board of directors of Krauss General at the time, was a franchisee. He had already signed up a franchise and was trying to talk his brother into investing in the corporation he had formed to operate the subway. So he was a franchisee acting in that capacity. There was no need to sell a franchise. It already been sold. Denton Olson's brother, the guy who they didn't call or didn't take his deposition, was the one who made the representation. So it is clearly hearsay. It was not done in the capacity as an agent. She had the right to make that ruling, and she did not abuse her discretion.
Why isn't it an admission against interest against Blimpie if Steve Abbott is there, present, never says anything about it, never says, oh, those statements aren't being made for us?
First of all, I don't think mere silence is an admission,
No, but this man's a board of directors also, so I mean those two in combination.
Except that he was as a franchisee, not trying to talk Dent into making money for Krauss General by buying another franchise. The brother had already paid. The brother was trying to talk his brother into going into something that already existed. So I think the court did not abuse its discretion in making the ruling. But equally fundamental, the error was harmless. Denton Olson proved nothing. I mean, he did testify at trial. They didn't offer a dime's worth of evidence on his damages or anything else. Once there was this ruling, that was just the end of it. And so I don't think there was any error or harmless. The error was harmless because they didn't offer any proof anyway.
So you're saying if he gets knocked out on the evidence as to representations, he still has to go and make an offer of proof as to all of his damages and prove up his whole case just in chambers and before he's entitled to have it reversed?
Not in chambers, but you lose one evidentiary ruling on a hearsay objection when there are lots of other ways to prove various elements. If I lost one hearsay objection and quit and lost the case and came up offered no other evidence of anything, I couldn't expect to get much of a reception from this court when I simply folded my tent and left. And that's what happened here. They lost one evidentiary ruling about one statement and quit. Offered no other evidence. So there are other ways of proving it. There are other evidence, obviously, that he had to show. They didn't do anything. They quit. The error is harmless. If there isn't, I don't think the court abuses discretion in that regard. I'll talk about the subway thing for a minute. It was undisputed that Abbott went to Blimpie International and was shown advertising that Blimpie International intended to offer. They were using the same advertising firm as Subway had been using. And in fact, Mr. Rensler, one of the plaintiffs, saw the same advertising and was shown the same things that Steve Abbott was shown, and he was excited about it. The problem was, in the end, when they got to their 1,500th store, and that's what they said, they're going to undertake this program, when they got to the 1,500th store, what nobody anticipated was they said, whoops, we can't afford it. But they still did national advertising. Everybody conceded they did national radio and TV advertising. The plaintiffs just didn't like it, didn't think it was good enough. And while we're on the subway issue, and I think this goes back to Justice Sinner's question earlier about, gee whiz, the jury found this, shouldn't give it some credibility. Jack Rensler admitted candidly that he shut his store down long before Blimpie International was ever going to undertake national advertising. Months before the date that they got their 1,500 stores, Mr. Rensler candidly admitted that didn't cause me any harm. I left long before they would have done this advertising. So whether they did or didn't cause me any harm. Jury still found that. Randy Heaton, same thing. He quit his store months before Blimpie International got to its 1,500th store and supposedly should have undertaken this advertising. But the jury still said, you can recover for that, even though you went out of business long before that should have taken place. So this in each instance, and I don't want to go through our brief, obviously, because you have it, there are specific undisputed facts, such as I've described for Rensselaer and Heaton, that just show, as a matter of law, these people cannot make out a case any better than their own testimony, and their own testimony dooms them. On the question about the $18,000 individual losses and that sort of thing, the verdict form makes it very clear that there are only four categories of losses possible: operating losses, capital losses, lost profits, and loss of business value. Okay? In each instance, the jury awarded nothing for lost profits, nothing for loss of business value, but instead the operating losses and capital losses. In each instance, those were presented by Mr. Sherman as their expert as corporate losses. There was an excellent point brought up about losing the farm. Okay. Mrs. Fritzmeier testified that she lost the family farm. That wasn't a claimed element of damage. Okay. What was submitted to the jury were these corporate losses. And so there wasn't things claimed other than for sympathy that actually became an element of damage, and they are all corporate losses, and there was a voluntary choice to try to present this David versus Goliath approach with the individuals and not in the name of the proper party, and the consequences need to be applied.
Was there evidence, however, that those losses that are identified as corporate losses in the jury verdict form, that those were monies, though, that the individuals actually put into that corporation? They were all individual monies, that perhaps from the farm?
There was testimony about what each person had done, yes. But there wasn't a separate, Janet Fritzmeier has a line item for her individual damages of the money that she put in. The money she put in, or that the others did, if any, doesn't correlate to the category or the amount of damages that was awarded by the jury.
So what is the capital loss category then? Give me an example of what that was. What would the jury have found?
The corporation buying equipment that kind of thing. You know, that's capital loss. It was mentioned, somebody asked a question, I apologize, I forget who on the court, about guarantees, that sort of thing. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in Taha v. Engstrand, 987 F. 2nd 505, held that even if a shareholder has been a guarantor, that does not entitle the shareholder to recover for what are corporate losses. That was applying Iowa law. We cited in our brief a number of other cases that hold exactly the same, you cannot, just because you're a guarantor, recover what should be in the name of the corporation. Obviously, we've looked through a very narrow window today at a very large picture, and I hope I've answered the questions the court has because my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Sanford. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.